Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, will Congress accomplish anything before leaving Washington for the month of August? Believe it or not, the answer may be yes.
But first, to eastern Ukraine, where for a third day in a row, heavy fighting has prevented a team of Dutch and Australian forensic experts from doing their work at the site of downed Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. Also today, Ukrainian officials said that data from the plane's black boxes show it was destroyed by shrapnel from a missile. And yesterday, U.S. officials released satellite images they say show that rockets have been fired from Russia into Ukraine. Joining us by Skype from Ukraine is The Wall Street Journal's Paul Sani. And Paul, how bad is this fighting that these inspectors can't get in?
The fighting is bad. What we're seeing now is the Ukrainian troops are making a push to essentially take control of what is the crash site, which effectively would wall off Donetsk, which is one of the main rebel strongholds where I am now, from both the Russian border and from other rebel groups in neighboring Lugansk, which is the other main region that has a separatist rebellion. Yeah. So the villages where Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 fell have seen the war come to them, really for the first time.
Well, it literally came to them. We're reading horrendous reports. One victim of the plane downing crashed through the roof of a woman's home and was in her kitchen for days. I mean, just terrible stories. But while the forensic investigators can't get there, you write a heartbreaking story about the parents of a 25-year-old engineering grad student who could get to the scene of the plane crash. They traveled from Australia, reached the site on Saturday. We want to talk about who their daughter was, but how did they get there?
Yeah, well, they took a circuitous route. They came from Perth, Australia. They initially flew to Europe through Holland, where they gave their DNA to Dutch investigators with the hopes of eventually retrieving their daughter's remains or their daughter's body, and they're doing that DNA matching now in the Netherlands. And then they drove into the conflict zone. And, you know, they were very, very lucky in a sense in terms of reaching the conflict site because they actually were there on the last day when anyone was able to go before the fighting sort of encroached around that area.
No, well, heartbreaking. They are trained scientists. Their daughter was an aerospace engineering grad student at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. She'd given TEDx talks. Just tell us a little bit about what happened for them there.
Yeah, they're a really sweet family, actually, and they're kind of this family of dreamers who really respect science and really respects technology, but also they're also into homeopathic medicine. And so their daughter was very much like that as well. She was, as you said, an engineering, aerospace engineering graduate student. And one of the things that she was working on is she had started her own company on the side where she was trying to create a system whereby nano satellites, so small satellites in space, each person on Earth would have one, and the nano satellite would be able to communicate information to people on Earth and also warn them if they were near emergencies. Yeah. So as some of her friends said, it's very sad that the system wasn't already in place before she got on the plane. She had studied how airplanes work, how they can disintegrate, how structural disintegration of aircraft, and, you know, had even discussed with her parents how to escape from a plane.
Well, given that, you say that one of the reasons the parents went to the site is they thought maybe she could have survived. Maybe she was in a coma on the ground.
Yeah, so I think the way that the Duchinskys described it to us was that they received the news of the plane being downed, and they immediately turned to the news and saw all of these images of chaos and you know, no Red Cross on the scene, not a lot of experts on the scene. And, you know, like any parent, you know, you always hold out hope that somehow where she was sitting helped her live, or, you know, the fact that she knew something about airplanes and, you know, was very ready for this, that she somehow something could have happened and she could be the exception. And, you know, if she was, given the chaos and given the fact that no one was really tending to the site, would anyone have even found her or, you know, and paid attention to her?
Well, it's just heartbreaking. But it also, I mean, it raises questions. Of course, these people should be allowed to go to the site where their child we know has died. But how does that compromise the site that people are just walking through it?
Well, by the time they got to the site, thousands of people had walked through it. Yeah. You know, and it hasn't been roped off or cordoned off. No part of it has been cordoned off from day one. It encompasses three different villages. A lot of the pieces of the plane and bodies fell on places where people live, and so it certainly couldn't have been cordoned off. And now it's in the middle of a war.
The Wall Street Journal's Paul Sani in Donetsk in Ukraine. Paul, thank you.
Thanks.
There are just a few days left until Congress takes its August break, and there is a lot left to be done. One item that stands a good chance of getting taken care of before the recess later this week is a bipartisan deal to reform health care at the Veterans Affairs Department, the VA. After continued negotiations over the weekend, the bill's sponsors, Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent from Vermont, and Congressman Jeff Miller, a Republican from Florida, say a compromise has been reached. Ron Elving is NPR senior Washington correspondent. He joins us to talk about that and some of the other business that may or may not get done before Congress leaves Washington. Ron, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, and let's start with this VA proposal. As we know, the VA has been under fire since reports surfaced of vets who were waiting months for a doctor's appointment. A new report shows that about 46,000 veterans had to wait at least 3 months for an initial appointment. What would this bill do about that?
The first thing the bill would do would be to give the new Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and that's going to be Robert McDonald. We expect to see him confirmed by the Senate this week. Give him new authority to deal with longtime managers and administrators in the VA who are deemed to be part of the problem. And there could be, as a result, scores and maybe even hundreds of demotions and firings throughout the VA on an expedited basis under this legislation.
And it would also allow people, if they are waiting for too long, to go to private doctors, right?
That's right. There are several things that this bill is going to do, and that includes money, $5 billion to hire more doctors and nurses and improve facilities. But to go directly to that issue of people in long waiting lines, the bill includes another $10 billion to empower a private care option for veterans who either live more than 40 miles from a VA facility or have been waiting a long time for appointments or admission.
Now, is it likely to get through Congress?
You know, it has not been an easy negotiation. There were 28 members of the House and Senate on the negotiating committee, and this was contentious at times, looked to have broken down a couple of times. Senator Sanders is an independent, as you said, from Vermont, and he is a very independent from Vermont. He chairs a committee under the regime of the Senate Democratic majority, though, so he has to bring along the Democrats in the Senate. And he is not shy, and he's a great advocate for veterans, has been for a long time. And so he pressed for larger sums in this bill than Congressman Miller, who was chairing from the House side, felt the House could accept. And while the House majority wants to be pro-veteran, and of course, wants to address these abuses in the VA, there was also some feeling that they shouldn't bust the budget or add to the deficit.
Well, but it might pass. Ron Robin here, jumping in to say that, you know, there might be compromise in this case. But before we pop the champagne, there's so much Congress hasn't gotten to. Where are we on President Obama's ask for nearly $4 billion to help with the border crisis?
You know, Robin, I think it's safe to say the president will not get that sum. The Senate was willing to go along with most of it. The House is talking about maybe $1 billion instead. Now, of course, depending on how that money gets spread out over time and just how it gets applied, that does not necessarily mean that they would not be going along with what needs to be done at the border. The sticking point here, though, is that the House Republicans don't want to put any more money into immigration policies they oppose. Mm-hmm. They want to make changes in the bill that was passed back in 2008 requiring full immigration hearings for minors who arrive at the border on their own. So that is partly what has created this situation, largely what has created the backlog, the sudden backlog, and they want to go at that too. And if we go at that, then that bogs down the negotiations with the Senate, and it might not get done this week. But if the spirit of cooperation we saw here in recent hours and days on the VA bill were to prevail, then we could still see action on that this week.
And you say you mentioned that 2008 law. That's the law that distinguishes between children coming from, let's say, Mexico, a border country, and those from non-contiguous countries. It says that the latter have to have hearings. But there's that. And then there's this money that we heard had to be had to fix crumbling roads and bridges across the country, that so many jobs were going to be lost if this extension to the Highway Trust Fund wasn't passed. The House did pass a 10-month extension. What about the Senate?
The Senate was balking at that 10-month extension, partly because they want a more permanent fix to the problem of the Highway Trust Fund itself. I mean, this is our main source of funds for building roads and bridges and repairing those that have worn out. And, you know, the Senate was grumpy about not getting a permanent fix, and it doesn't do anything to restore the health of the Highway Trust Fund in the long run because it relies on a tax, the gas tax. And that's been stuck at 18 cents a gallon for more than 20 years. So it's just not adequate any longer to replenish the fund, but there's no agreement on what to do instead. And so we have this 10-month patch, and the Senate will probably relent and pass it.
Mm-hmm. Ron, I want to just give Congress the benefit of the doubt here, because I guess the assumption would be that they really haven't done very much of anything, certainly since President Obama was reelected. They didn't pass immigration reform, which looked like it had the biggest chance of anything of getting through. Have they done anything this session that we're not talking about here? Is there something that was passed that just didn't make the headlines? Give us something here.
Fair is fair. Back in February, the president signed into law the Farm Bill, and the Farm Bill was left over from the wrangles of 2013. And that's a big deal. It sets the policy for agriculture and forest policy for a number of years into the future. And it was difficult, and it got done, and it got signed into law. Since then, the House and Senate have been primarily passing bills that the other chamber is probably not going to touch. So the Senate passed the sexual assault in the military bill to toughen up the way that the military deals with allegations of sexual assault. And the House passed something to extend the child tax credit so that that would be available to people with somewhat higher incomes. And neither of those two chambers is probably going to see the corresponding chamber pick up that particular piece of legislation. So we see a lot of investigations, and we see a bill for suing the president. The House is probably going to go ahead and pass that.
Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington correspondent, as Congress wraps up for the month of July this week and will be gone for the month of August. Ron, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you both.
Today, the trustees for Medicare and Social Security released their annual report on the financial health of those entitlement programs. And here are the two key numbers, 2030 and 2033. Medicare will remain solvent until 2030. That's 4 years later than previously anticipated. And it's in part because of the Affordable Care Act. Social Security's solvency did not change. It will not have enough money to pay full benefits by 2033, according to today's forecast. Joining us is Eric Kingston. He's professor of social work at Syracuse University and co-founder of Social Security Works. He's also worked on two presidential commissions on Social Security. Eric, welcome to Here and Now.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, and what does this report tell you about the health of, let's start with the Social Security program?
Well, nothing very surprising. The system remains quite strong. Americans can count on it to meet all their obligations, young and old. There is sufficient. The trust funds, which will grow to $2.8 trillion this year, up a little bit. And it has sufficient funds to meet all obligations till 2033, same as last year. After that, it's about 23 cents short on every dollar the American people have earned through their contributions.
And that's a pretty significant problem, though, isn't it, down the road? I mean, yes, it's 2033. That's 19 years away, but it's not that long in the grand scheme.
No. Stepping back, though, in the grand scheme, it's not that long. It is something we need to address. It is not it's far from an insurmountable concern. It would say, an example, we've seen tremendous inequality, increases in inequality in our society. If you go back to 1949 through 1979, two-thirds of the income growth of the nation went to the bottom 90%. Fast forward from 1980 through today, two-thirds has gone to the top 1%. The problem isn't that we're a poor nation. The problem is that the money has gone in extraordinarily inequitable ways, and that in terms of Social Security, the fact that the economy is far more unequal than it had been has also helped undermine Social Security's financing.
So you've made the case there for Social Security being a very important thing for people in this country. But the question remains about what to do with it. I want to just take you back. Well, just one second here. Let me just take you back, because the last time that a big change was made was back in the early 80s. Ronald Reagan was president, and the age was raised from 65 to 67 for future beneficiaries. Here's Ronald Reagan speaking back then.
We're entering an age when average Americans will live longer and live more productive lives. And these amendments adjust to that progress. The changes in this legislation will allow Social Security to age as gracefully as all of us hope to do ourselves, without becoming an overwhelming burden on generations still to come.
Eric Kingston, does the age need to go up again at some point in the next 20 years?
Absolutely not. What I would just going back to the 1980s, and I was staff to that commission. The world was different. We had a real crisis. If Social Security didn't have legislation in 1983, it would have had to cut benefits if it didn't have legislation by then. More importantly, at that point in time, we expected incomes to continue to grow and the patterns of all Americans sharing in that growth continuing. We expected the private pension systems would be stronger. Today, they're much weaker. The defined benefits are a thing of the past almost. We expected home housing to be a secure asset for people, and we've seen in the recent near collapse of our economy that for many Americans, it's not a secure asset. Back then, Social Security was one piece of a retirement income system. Today, it really is the retirement income system. It's also the life insurance system for our children and the disability insurance system. Two-thirds of young Americans in their 20s will either be disabled or deceased by age 67. Now, to back up on that, retirement age, it sounds great. And you hear lots of people with very secure jobs and in good health saying, look, everybody's living longer. We can work longer.
Yeah.
And everyone should. But what they miss is, firstly, everyone isn't living longer. Life expectancy has declined for lower income people, for people with less education. It is also true that the reason raising retirement age would reduce a projected shortfall in Social Security is because it takes dollars out of the pockets of the American people. Every year you raise it, it reduces benefits by 6 to 7%. In 83, Congress reduced benefits a total of about 24%. Today, we can't afford to do that, which is why increasingly more and more politicians are talking about expanding Social Security benefits.
But how do you make it solvent beyond 2033? Something's going to have to change
yes.
at some point.
You ask millionaires and billionaires to pay their share, fair share. You increase the cap. Right now, you only pay on earnings up to $117,000. You say, pay like everyone else. Pay the same payroll tax rate as your secretaries, your workers. Pay 6.2% of your earnings, 6.2%, and the employer matches that, on all your earnings. That in itself would address about 70, 75%, 80%.
Let me just ask you this, though. Doesn't that cause another problem, which is that one of the great things about Social Security is that it does feel like a very democratic system where you don't have people paying different amounts based on their income levels, that everybody's buying into this thing at the same level. And if you make rich people pay more than they are now, it changes the nature of the system.
No, good point. It doesn't though, because right now you would still receive a benefit increase related to your contribution into the system. One could eliminate the so-called cap, or what some people call scrap the cap, and give very, very modest additional credit into it. It's also not unreasonable to be talking about putting a tax on the millionth dollar that would go into Social Security. Given the absolute skyrocketing increase in income of the top 0.1%, it's not unreasonable to say that at $1 million of earnings, we could take an extra 10% and dedicate that to Social Security. There are many things that can be done on the revenue side. The thing we can't afford to do, with two-thirds of Americans working people today, Two-thirds of them are heading towards a retirement where they cannot maintain their standard of living. The very last thing we can afford to do is to cut benefits. We need to be doing things like Senator Harkin, Senator Brown have been talking about, the idea of expanding benefits, providing a more secure cost of living adjustment, and paying for those, of course, and we can afford to pay for it. Social Security is very modest. We're looking at an average benefit of $15,000.
But still one that has become very important for a lot of people. And a lot of people are going to be looking at this report today.
Yes.
You can get a link to it at our website, hereandnow.org. And let us know what you think should be done to shore up Social Security in the long term. Eric Kingston, professor of social work at Syracuse and a founder of Social Security Works. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. And may I add one thing?
Nope, because we're out of time. I'm sorry. But thanks again. This is Here and Now. Two big corporate deals to tell you about today. The online real estate company Zillow has agreed to buy its biggest rival, Trulia, for $3.5 billion. That's a deal that could be a game changer in the world of online real estate listings and real estate in general. And Dollar Tree is buying Family Dollar in a deal valued at $8.5 billion. Joining us now is Howard Davidowitz, chairman of Davidowitz & Associates. That's a retail consulting firm. Howard, welcome back.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, why are these two dollar stores, these discount retailers, getting together?
One reason is outside investors putting a lot of pressure on Family Dollar, which has had earning problems led by Carl Icahn, pushing them to sell, probably the right thing to do for the shareholders. This is a great segment. If you look at American retailing, the extreme value segment led by Dollar Tree, Dollar General, Family Dollar. One has been the fastest growing, highest return on investment, highest profitability. And then when you look at the overall American economy, we've seen in the last 6 years double the number of people in poverty. 6 years ago, we had 1 out of 12 Americans in poverty. Now we have 1 out of 6 Americans in poverty. So their audience is growing tremendously. We've doubled the number of people on food stamps, double the number of people on poverty. The middle class has shrunk tremendously. The number of people in poverty have grown tremendously. These stores appeal to those with very little money. The motivation to go there is a rock-bottom price. So, number one, they're growing like crazy. They're built, you know, these people are building thousands of stores a year as a group. So it's a great sector, extreme value. And if somebody gets a little weak, somebody's going to gobble them up because it's going to be a great deal.
But if you've got two of them getting together, just like if you had, let's say, two airlines getting together, do you see prices go up? Does it become the $2 store?
There's no way, because the winner in this is Dollar Tree. They are the cheapest of the cheap. Their stores don't sell anything above a dollar. If you look at who they're acquiring Family Dollar, whose most of their prices are in the $5 to $10 range. I would expect Family Dollar's prices to come down. Dollar Tree has the greatest return on investment and offers the lowest prices. So, no, I don't expect the prices to go up at all. I expect the prices to go down. These folks have been grabbing customers from Walmart and Target because they're the cheapest. I don't think they're going to forget that.
How does a Dollar General feel about this, two competitors getting together?
Oh, I don't think they're too happy about it because now they're competing against a bigger company that will have more power with the suppliers, will have more power with the real estate community, will have more ability with the real estate and be able to attract better people, operate at lower costs. They'll be able to leverage their costs over a wider base and offer even better deals. So I don't think any of the competitors are going to be too happy. I'm shocked that Walmart did not go after Family Dollar. I can't believe they didn't do it. They're building smaller stores. They've been jerking around for 12 years. They've never made it work, and they didn't go after this deal. I'm shocked. But I think this is a very workable deal.
Howard Davidowitz, chairman of Davidowitz & Associates, talking with us about the big news today in the retail sector that Dollar Tree and Family Dollar are getting together. Howard, thanks so much.
Thanks for the invitation.
Old-fashioned house calls may be making a comeback. The government is in the middle of a three-year pilot project to test whether house calls could save money and provide better care for some of the highest-cost patients, older people on Medicare. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WHYY contributor and Drexel Medical student Avir Mitra looks at efforts to bring back house calls.
I'm with Jonathan Warren, a retired internal medicine doctor in his mid-70s, as he takes a break from volunteering at a busy nursing home. I asked him whether he ever made house calls.
Oh, yes. Yes, I used to make house calls. I used to go around and see people on my bicycle. And I had a dog, and I used to take my dog sometimes, too.
I asked Dr. Warren to describe his first house call. He told me it was a visit to the home of an elderly woman.
I went to the woman's house. She had two daughters. They were both there. They said that she's eating very poorly and she's lost weight. Okay. So I go and examine her, and sure enough, I thought she was in heart failure. I had her lie down in bed, and I looked at her neck veins, and I looked at the swelling of her legs. And then when it was all over, they really appreciated just the fact that I went to the house. They said, Dr. Warren, we want you to sit now. We're going to give you a Lebanese lunch. And it was wonderful. That was the dream of the whole day.
Believe it or not, these type of interactions with your doctor used to be the norm. In 1930, 40% of physician visits were house calls. But by 1980, that number had dropped to 1%.
People liked it. It was interesting. And you get a sense about what their lives were like and what their homes were like.
If a patient had a rash and you saw bed bugs, well, there was your answer. If they offered you dinner, you might taste too much salt. Seeing the patient at home put their disease in the context of their environment. Seeing a patient in an office or a hospital in some ways is like seeing a fish out of water.
At one point in time, it was really fun. Medicine was really fun. It's not as much fun anymore.
But as the power of modern medicine, the x-rays, the blood tests, the surgical procedures, all of it, grew exponentially, it only made sense to abandon the house call model in favor of a more efficient hospital-based system. After all, that's where the doctors actually had the tools to do things. But that special intimacy between doctor and patient was gone. Forever. Or maybe not. Recently, two medical students from Temple University won third place in a national competition sponsored by the Association of Medical Colleges, in which contestants were asked to make a video that would envision the medical innovations of tomorrow. Instead of imagining spaceships and alien medicine, they had an interesting vision. Students Aaron Hickey and Nick Osavala imagined a future with house calls.
And the way it worked was that a medical student and a resident sort of showed up at a patient's house.
She opens the door. She's excited to see them. She has had this relationship with them for a long time, and she trusts them. So they walk in. How are you? They sit down. They start talking about how she's feeling, you know, what's changed in her health since the last visit.
And then at that point, they beam in holographically an attending physician from the main university hospital.
From here, the team uses futuristic technology to read her blood work and send the data back to the hospital. The attending advises them remotely.
Your idea about the future, it's kind of retro in a way.
Sure, but we wanted to bring the house call back because we thought it might be the best way to sort of tie in the technological advances in the next 20 and 30 years, but maintain that level of personal care that I think is the reason why we all decided to get into this in the first place.
But for now, their vision is just that, a vision. Yet maybe if we look closely, we can see the signs of a shift starting to take place. As the population gets older and frailer, and as hospital infection rates go up, there's a new incentive to bring healthcare back to the home.
It's Dr. Kanosian.
This is Bruce Kanosian. He's a primary care doctor and associate professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And he makes house calls.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Mr. Singleton.
Dr. Kanosian let me tag along today as we visit James Singleton, a retired Army veteran who lives in West Philly. Last year, James had a stroke with multiple medical complications that left him bedbound. But thanks to a year of house calls from a multidisciplinary team, he's been steadily improving.
So what are you putting on this?
We got right to business by asking James how he was feeling, getting vitals, and changing bandages. But the conversation soon veered into directions no regular office visit would ever take. We discussed the new ramp we saw on his porch. And when James complained of constipation, we took a look in his fridge and noticed a lot of dairy.
How would you feel with trying lactose-free ice cream and milk for a week?
All right, no problem.
We looked in his medicine cabinet.
You can see what medicines they have. You can also see all the other medicines that they have that they didn't bring in that you didn't know about.
Then Dr. Kanosian broke out his medicine bag, and what came out was anything but retro.
Pulse oximeter, glucometer. There are pocket ultrasound devices that, because of smart software, can double as an echocardiogram, as an abdominal ultrasound, as a Doppler looking for a blood clot in the leg. There's a blood analyzer.
Dr. Kanosian has James hold an iPhone, which has a case with metal leads on it. He opens an EKG app.
Yeah, blinking.
And it's measuring your heart.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Amazed.
Remember the student's video we heard earlier? Maybe it wasn't pure science fiction after all. In fact, this entire visit is part of a little-known experiment called Independence at Home, written into the Affordable Care Act. Its purpose is to beta test the house call as a way to deal with the 10% of Medicare patients who account for 2/3 of Medicare's expenditures. The theory is that for these high-cost patients, house calls might actually be more efficient, more effective, and ultimately cheaper. In its first year, it saved the program 25%.
People live longer, and almost all of that life was spent out of nursing homes. Yeah, so it was one of those that saves money and gives people a higher quality of life, so it's sort of a general win-win.
10 years of data from Dr. Kanosian's team were a big part of getting Independence at Home into the Affordable Care Act in the first place. It was their results with VA patients like James Singleton that convinced senators that a demo was warranted. Right now, the pilot is limited to 10,000 patients. If after 3 years the results show overall savings for Medicare, that cap could be removed.
Well, now I think that Independence Home is going to radically transform how healthcare gets delivered and gets paid for in this country. There's probably 1.5 million Medicare beneficiaries that are eligible for Independence at Home.
In other words, the house call might be coming back in a big way.
Well, no, I mean, this is like the natural place to do this. No, when Mr. Singleton was first home, it would have been really difficult getting him out of the house. Mm-hmm. See how he's walking now? He was stuck in the bed.
So I asked Mr. Singleton.
I like this bed. It's beautiful. I love it. If it's hot outside, I can stay right in with the air conditioning. If it's cold, I can stay in with the heat. Yeah, enjoy every bit of it.
For Here and Now, I'm Avir Mitra in Philadelphia.
Rob Reiner was born to comedy royalty, the son of King Carl Reiner. Rob played Meathead in Norman Lear's classic All in the Family. He directed the romantic comedy When Harry Met Sally, the mock documentary This Is Spinal Tap, in which he also plays the documentarian who can't understand why anyone would want a volume knob that goes to 11. Another Rob Reiner film, 1987's The Princess Bride, the story of the princess and the farm boy turned pirate who rescues her from marriage to an evil prince. One of the funniest wedding ceremonies ever, Peter Cook, the clergyman with the unfortunate speech impediment.
Marriage. Marriage is what brings us together today. Marriage, that blessed arrangement. That dream within a dream.
Oh, Rob Reiner's latest film is And So It Goes, a When Harry Met Sally for the senior set. Michael Douglas plays Orrin, a not very pleasant widower who begins a romance with his neighbor, played by Diane Keaton, a woman whose values he comes to appreciate, though as we hear in this scene, Orrin's courting skills need work.
Last time I had sex, I tore my ACL.
Is this relevant to anything?
Well, I just thought of some information that you should have.
Is this by any chance some pathetic attempt at flirtation?
Well, when you put it that way, no.
Good night, Orrin.
Recently, Rob Reiner visited us to talk about And So It Goes and more. Of course, everybody's thinking Harry Met Sally decades later.
Yes.
But you've said this, that there's sort of a same theme that reappears.
Yes, I basically make the same movie over and over again. It's men and women, and the only way that I can make a movie about them is to explore what I know about men, being one of them, and what women are, you know. And essentially what I've discovered, whether it's Flipped, which is about 12-year-olds or Sure Thing, they're teenagers, or When Harry Met Sally, or now And So It Goes, is essentially women are just more evolved than men. They know more of who they are. They're much more emotionally mature. They are more settled with what they want out of life in a relationship. And men kind of run around like idiots trying to figure out what's going on until they're able to see the wisdom of the woman that's right there in front of them and know what's important. It's the women that teach the men what is important in life.
It's played as if they are old. There's a lot of fumbling around when there's movement towards the bedroom. A lot of, I don't really know how to do this anymore. But then Diane Keaton at one point, who I think in real life she's maybe 68 and gorgeous, says, her character says, you know, I'm 65 and I'm not sure I can. And there was an audible gasp from people as I looked around who were saying to each other, like, what, 65? That's not old.
But I think that, you know, certainly for a young person, 65 is old. I mean, when I turned 60, I thought of myself at that point as a very, very, very young old person.
But there were people kind of shocked at that. I actually heard one guy, I don't know if we can say this, but I'm going to say it on public radio. I heard one person say, I know people in their 60s who are stooping all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, there was sort of, there was a little disconnect with the older people, the people in their 60s. And I know that's the audience you think is going to come out.
Yeah, I mean, what we're saying is that we are sexual beings and we will continue to be sexual beings, you know, until we go. And so that's what we're saying about this movie, which is you embrace life. You don't know how long you're going to live. Mm. You know, you could live a day, you know, or you could live many years. But if something presents itself, a person in front of you that you think, ooh, this is a person I like that I could spend time with, you know, sex does become a part of it. And it is still awkward, you know, for two people meeting for the first time. I don't care whether they're teenagers or they're experienced. It still has an awkwardness to
well,
it.
Well, and so they are older on screen. Now, men traditionally have been allowed to age on screen. Women have not. Diane Keaton, as I said, is gorgeous, but she allows her age to show. Did she fear that, you know, there are liver spots at times?
Yeah. Women always think about that, and she's no different from any other woman. So, you know, we wanted to make her look as good as she could. You know, you'll do it with certain lighting, and you have
but it's real.
Certain lenses. It's real. You want it to be real, but at the same time, you want it to, it's a romance, you know, so you want it to be romantic as well.
Rob Reiner, there's such affection for people in your films. Where does that come from?
I mean, well, I think, you know, it's celebrating our time on the planet. I love people. I love stories about people and what they go through. And what I like to say is, let's celebrate life. Let's celebrate it until it's over, you know, because it's going to be over. Mm-hmm. And so rather than, hit people on the head with, you know, all the things that are negative, and there are plenty of negative things in people, but you if you find the right way to blend the two, because that is the life experience.
Well, I wonder if that affection that just, it feels, that's the word I think of when I think of your films. I just wonder if that comes from the Hollywood that you must have grown up in. Your dad, Carl Reiner, of course, creator of classics like Dick Van Dyke Show, but then his friends, Mel Brooks, Norman Lear, there was a niceness.
Yeah, well, I mean, they have fun with each other. I mean, they like to make each other laugh. And I was very privileged to be around them and see how much they embraced and enjoyed life. And so, you know, listen, they have their dark sides, too. Anybody who makes humor for a living has got a dark side. But, you know, there's nothing better than trying to make people laugh. I mean, it's a great way to live your life.
I don't want to go all, you know, Oprah on you. But
okay.
Lie down. Are you out from under your dad's shadow? Were you ever under it? You feel pretty comfortable with it.
Yeah, I'm way out.
Way
of it,
out,
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly did experience it when I was young, growing up. I knew what that felt like. And they tell a story about me, and I don't remember doing this, but my mother says that when I was about 8 years old, I went to her and I said to her, you know, I want to change my name. And she thought, oh, this poor kid, you know, he's living under the shadow of Carl Reiner, and it's too much for him. And she said, well, what do you want to change your name to? And I said, Carl. And so it was a big shadow, but I still liked him, and I love him, and I wanted to be him. And I idolized him. I looked up to him. So, yeah, it was rough when I was a kid, but, you know, I've made my bones, as they say.
Yeah. While we have you, we have to ask you about one of your earlier films that's still a favorite, 1987's The Princess Bride. It still has a devoted following, people who can quote lines. One of the actors is publishing As You Wish, Inconceivable Tales from the Making of The Princess Bride. That's a memoir about making the film.
Yeah, it's Cary Elwes has written a book. I mean, you know, I get it all the time. And Mandy Patinkin said he doesn't have a day go by when somebody doesn't come up and say to him, you know, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. I remember one time, you know, years ago when Nora Ephron was still alive, we went to a restaurant that she said to me, well, John Gotti, you know, he likes to come to this restaurant. Let's
go. The mob boss, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we went there, and we're sitting there, and around 8 o'clock in walks John Gotti with like six wise guys around him. So now we finish our meal. I walk outside, and there's a limo parked outside with a man standing in front of it that looks like Luca Brasi from The Godfather. And he looks at me, and he says, you killed my father. Prepare to die. And I thought, oh, my God, I almost went on the sidewalk there. And then he says, I love that movie, The Princess Bride. So it's definitely made its way into the culture.
Oh, Rob Reiner, his latest film is And So It Goes. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
What a nice, nice guy. And Princess Bride, based on William Goldman's book and screenplay. Oh, the best lines, Jeremy. Have fun storming the castle. Murdered by pirates is good. You have lines
so nice to be brought back to that. It actually reminded me of another Rob Reiner film. I guess he was just a bit part, but it was hilarious. Steve Martin's film, Mixed Nuts.
Oh, we have
yeah,
got your...
Yeah, he was the veterinarian.
All right, we've got your films all lined up. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.